Hearing anything anymore. If anyone can hear me.
dead air on the my mic may have been part of the problem. This button was turned off. This little button here. That's why I could barely hear me, because I was hearing myself through the other mics that I had open. So, Terrence, if you can hear me now, call me at 718-780-8888. And would you believe me, Catherine, if I told you that the person who texted me was coming from nowhere closer than Bulgaria? That's far out. That's just, you know, that's one of the 21st century things that I really like. One of the things that we were promised by science fiction, one of the very few. We're not on Mars. We don't have flying cars. We don't have a peaceful world government. But we do have, we're able to reach out to all of you all over the world. Maybe one day during the fundraising drive in May, we should just target countries. We should just target boroughs. Everybody in Queens, let's do, like, you know, everybody in, ooh, I've got it, Iceland. You've got all that offshore money that you can pledge, right? Give us some of that offshore money to keep Pacifica Radio broadcasting, right? Hi there, Terrence. Is that you, Terrence?
Yes, it is.
Oh, good. Thank you. Yeah, so it was a bleep up here. A number three up.
I checked the link online and wasn't hearing anything there that you are actually off the air.
Weren't off the air. I was just not. My mic wasn't on. Well, what I do, Catherine, is the list, right? I use the numbers on the list. So I can say that, you know, I really threed up. You know, and I know that number two is a lot of people off, but I don't give a one. So we have code. It's safe harbor, right?
I suppose. I'm not sure what any of that meant. I'm actually trying to get a little more volume on your piece here.
Yeah, first, Terrence, thank you so much for, don't take this the wrong way, thank you so much for last night.
Oh, yes, the nurses, yes. Well, you're quite welcome. You're quite welcome.
Yeah, I've got to say, that was a landmark event. You know,
quite a nice house, yes.
It was a very nice house. I did a rough count, and I stopped at just about 90.
Nice.
So I dare say, including the fact that some people left at intermission, and some more people came in because now there was room for them. We had about 100 people.
Just below the amount to make the fire marshal.
I'm not sure what that is, but I was being very careful, and we made very sure also to keep the egress and access open.
Indeed.
But if anybody wants to watch it, you can either go on Facebook to the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings, NYRSF Readings group, and click on the link, or you can go to the Brooklyn Commons page, and you can see it there, or you can just go straight to live stream and do a search on NYRSF. And you will see most of the readings that we've done. And there were some minor technical issues last night involving sound at the very end.
Yes. It was getting very weird and everything with that boom trying to counter and figure out what that was. And it sounded like air conditioning to me. Then it was a different hum that I was hearing on air, but it added to it. So it was like
but it's not just
doubling the amount of hum.
But it's not just the hum and the buzz that I'm talking about. Carlos and Claire near the end were almost inaudible.
That would be the audio. That would be an audio issue.
No, that's what I'm saying. But it wasn't a buzz. It was that.
No, but it was also a volume thing. It was the volume thing happened in the trying to remove buzz, I think.
Yeah, I think so.
Or whatever. Thing is that the advantage of live stream is that one can, like, post videos. So I suspect that there must be a way to replace whatever video is up at that link with a version with clean audio, if we can successfully join video to your recorded audio. Now, I would suspect that, if you listen to your audio from last night, that actually you will hear the room noise.
I will hear the room noise, but I will also get a good volume on the last couple of readers.
Yeah, yeah. And that would, and actually the room noise being consistent, if it can be sampled, can be filtered out fairly easily in the auditions.
Yeah, so
there's ways to, like, you know, remount some of these things with better, because mine is going to be the test, because I have the drives from you with the audio and video for my reading with, I'm blocking out her name, Maria Devana Headley.
The divine Headley. Maria Devana Headley.
The divine. She was quite divine, actually. She was fabulous in oh so many ways. But I want to use that as a test to sort of try to track the audio recording at that time into the video to see if there's an issue. There had been an issue about synchronicity drifting, but that actually turns out to be a data rate issue. And it's easily corrected by running the audio through, imagine I could do it or something else, but certainly through Handbrake and making it a fixed data rate. Suddenly these things go into sync. So we should be able to actually do that. And at least the last season at the Commons, be able to go back and re-synchronize those at least.
And
back
of course
up
I've got the ones that were done at... The Soho Gallery for Visual Arts, which I used my Handycam.
Well, yeah, there's multiple videos going back for years. I'm just see, you're missing the unconscious desire to set limits to the process.
Yeah.
I find myself chained to a table in the basement of your building with a 1980s version of some editing program that you're forcing me to go and find media from the 70s. 16 millimeter films that you shot of readings in the beginning of Nurses.
Yes, exactly.
I find myself in an aging steam deck being forced to synchronize and restore frame by frame.
We've got the stuff that Samuel R. Delaney was doing here in 1967. Why limit yourself?
I know it. See, this is why I'm not letting you camel into that basement room. I know you.
Well, we just
It'll
have
be
to.
Like, you know, I'll be step by step, but I'll find myself in the depths of hell before I know.
No. We'll do this at your place or mine.
See? But there's the
I'll
doing
feed
it still.
You.
I will show you how to do. I will teach you to fish.
Okay.
I have much to do. I will teach you to fish. But the thing is that that was the sole issue. And if indeed I have found the resolution to that, then you can easily. I mean, you had the software to be able to combine audio.
Exactly. Yes, I do.
But it was that issue. If that's the issue, I can. And I'm going to check it with the video audio that I have to see if it still exists. It may no longer be a problem. But if with the earlier things where we know it's a problem, it would give us a solution, and that would be great.
So all that aside,
You
were on 2 weeks ago.
I was indeed. Was it 2 weeks already? Go ahead.
Yeah. Yes. And last week, Brooke Bolander was here.
Oh, that's right.
And you were on the phone, as you are now, 2 weeks ago. And, of course, you had opened, I don't even remember exactly what it was, but you had opened up a fascinating subject, like 3 minutes before we were to go off the air.
My traditional bum, bum, bum.
Yeah, exactly.
All those years of watching soap operas.
It's already April, and we still haven't dealt with last year's Doctor Who.
Which I have sitting in front of me on Wikipedia, because it's like, oh, God, if you want to talk to me, and I don't even remember the last season, but we'll go on about that later.
Yeah, and speculation about what the next season will be, and more importantly, what the entrance of Chris Chibnall as the new showrunner will do, and who will be the next companion.
Well, it will mean that Danielle will no longer be able to complain about Moffat. She'll have to complain about the new guy, unless she likes what he does.
Yes, exactly.
And she will be joined by all those various millions or thousands or however many people there are who share her sentiment.
She's not totally wrong.
I know she's not alone.
I'm not saying alone. I'm saying she's not totally wrong.
Yeah.
I think Moffat is, not a great showrunner, but I do think that he's the best writer.
Yes. though she's not thrilled with some of the storylines either, even just the written stuff.
Well, I
generally
the person who created Captain Jack and River Song.
And River Song is still maybe my favorite recent rebirth creation. I was just looking at the I have to go watch the Christmas episode again, which was quite fun. And then watch the next episode where she meets the doctor like he doesn't know her and dies, because that's interesting.
That's right.
Because I now see the fly. I hadn't realized that full circularity of this, of that episode going into that it really is their final date together. It may be 2 years long and a long night.
Yes.
But, well, but I'm going by Wiki.
Oh, that date, that date, yes.
But that date at the Twin Towers there, are there, which was rumored over Malaya to be the legendary last night of the Doctor and River Song, and it says that their final date together before River dies, meeting a younger doctor,
because
the library.
Because she had just finished that date with the current Richard II.
Right.
For those who don't know, David Tennant is currently playing Richard II at the Brooklyn Academy of Music.
Well, good for him. I didn't know that, actually. I've not been able to look at too many things other than the edit screen.
Well, suffice it to say that the tickets were sold out before they went on sale.
Yes, as was the free seating to see Patti Smith talking about Camus at Cooney.
Yeah.
I saw in the Times that, of course, was immediately snapped up. It would have been a fascinating couple of
months. Well, stuff at CUNY, you know who to talk to, right?
No.
Oh, think the words Invisible Universe.
Ah, okay. Oh, that's true. You're right.
Right.
I should talk to her. Yes.
Right.
I forget about that.
She's
in town a day or two a week. So.
Yes, so that's your key.
Let me in as... if nothing else, I can tell you if they're videotaping it. They'd even be happy just to watch a stream of it. You know, in the aftermath, I was on a panel at CUNY once, years ago, on children's television, which was very new. It was a nice panel. It was very fun. And I was told it was going to be aired online afterwards, but never quite tracked down where that link was. They seemed a little bit vague in terms of actually following through on that. So I have to check with her, but if nothing else, one would think, my God, they would have some document being made of that event. Why would they not videotape that? And why would you not stream it on your website? I mean, my God,
well, exactly.
They've done the wonderful things there.
Are they
so
also
simple
their own
now.
Channel?
Well, exactly.
Channel
so they've
75
got to,
in New York
somehow.
Is CUNY TV.
Yeah, so I've got to check with her, but you're right. She would know exactly what's going on.
Yeah.
Tell me who to find out, because... I mean, I don't care if I'm there. I would just love to hear what she has to say. She's a fascinating speaker. I saw her in a book signing in Dumbo a couple summers ago when Just Kids came out and got a copy and had her sign it. I was trying desperately to show her photos from the concert that I had restored photos from at a Palladium concert in, 81, I think. And, of course, she's, it made it quite clear in the course of her speaking that she had pretty much just staggered off of the plane, still just like the last flight, to get there. And she was remarkably coherent, did a lovely job, was fascinating, and just wanted to get through the signing part and go home. It was and everyone, of course, is having a minute with Patti Smith, and everyone is wanting to talk to her about how profoundly she affected everything in their life.
Well,
and
I'm
oh, my God, I've got to put this moment and perception of this moment into
something. So since you're doing post on her movie, am I going to be in the final cut?
Oh, we haven't even gotten near there. We're doing piecemeal segments. So
yeah.
Right now we've been doing the 90s, the genre of filmmaking in the 90s. I'm going into a section on Octavia Butler, which is actually going to be very nice.
Which is something that you and she, because either during the next fund drive or the one after that, I want to do a five-hour show of the legacy of Junie Butler. So, as she was called by family members, not by friends, but by family members, she was Junie.
Now, I presume that level of intimacy. I met her at two readings, and she seemed not to terribly much let me hit either. I I sort of annoyed her with a question at one, and the other one, I think it was sort
of... I probably constantly... She was on this show about five times. At the back of my mind. Or four times plus one interview, one recorded interview.
Sure she was going, it's that guy again. Is he following me across the country? Because I stayed in Seattle 2 days.
Hey, she came to my house for dinner. It's one of my... I've cooked for that woman.
Well, then you did not annoy her as much as I.
I guess not, but then again...
I'm trying to find...
Her editor.
I have a copy of Blood Child here somewhere, which popped into my head the other day when I was putting the Octavia interview footage into the computer. And I have to go clear action figures off my bookshelves.
Do you think that's the book listeners should read first?
What?
Do you think that Blood Child ought to be, like, if you don't know Octavia Butler, is that the book to start with?
I don't remember it that well because I bought it years ago and read it years ago, and it was like I had completely forgotten about it.
Okay, let me.
I mean, even as I was looking at book covers of other stuff, that hadn't leapt to mind. Excuse me, but it came up in something online. I was looking for video obituaries of her, which I had no luck finding. But it was reading some of the print media pieces, and it was referenced in one of those. And I remembered, oh my God, wait, I bought that. I remember that. Oh my God, yes. Oh wow, I bought it at the Strand. I was at the Strand, and I was actually specifically looking for work by Butler at the time. And they had these two really big copies of this really beautiful hardcover edition of Blood Child with a lovely cover, and I have to find it. But I was trying to figure out if I have anything autographed by her because I went to two readings. I must have had her sign a book for me.
I
wouldn't.
I have an autographed Parable of the Sowers.
Yeah, well, that's what I should look at, maybe. And actually, that might be what I got.
It's one of her best, but I, of course, love the short stories.
Well,
and that's why
Sowers.
Blood Child and Help Me, Kins.
What?
Kinship? Not Kinship. What's the title?
Kindred.
Kindred,
the first
thank you.
Novel, yeah.
Thank you.
I mean, Kindred's the one that generally I think people sort of go for most. I mean, I would really, as a start, would go for the Pattern Master series, which was just absolutely brilliant and created... I'm looking here for this book. I should not distract myself. But created a... premise that flowed through at least three, were there four novels of the Pattern Master series? But the whole construct of Doro and Doro's children and the idea of this immortal African being who can move from body to body and over centuries has just been cross-pollinating various members of the black race who has special abilities to try to create others like him. It's just so... epic and amazing, and it just became for me this wonderful explanation of so much of the dysfunction of modern black American life. It was like, those crazy black guys you see on the subway who are talking to themselves, they're Doro's children, they're the failed experiments. They have some ability that's driving them nuts. They can't control it. They don't understand it. That's what sent them over the edge. And, there are just so many layers in that book and the different patterns of behavior and character. That just applied and sort of in a strange way explained aspects of contemporary black life at the time. So it became very identifiable. You could really, it was so easy to immerse yourself in because it was very much like Dahlgren. I had this lovely essay that was talking about that aspect of Dahlgren, that it's set in a world that has fantastic elements but is so prosaic and everyday in other ways that it's very easy to accept the extremes. I read Parable of the Sower as I was leaving Los Angeles in 2001, and it was chilling because it so perfectly encapsulated my view about Los Angeles at that time and my feelings about where it was headed if it didn't seriously learn some lessons, which it seems to have learned some of. I think Underground has gotten better in certain aspects, but I could be wrong. But the shift in her work from the small concept of kindred, which is large in a certain way, but a very intimate, personal, small story, to the growth through the Pattern Master series, up to the Parable books, which just were so much the culmination of that path, you know, in terms of being able to just blend all those things and make them just completely believable, well, which is the thing, you know, both actors and writers, you know, must always aspire to, is just simply whatever you're doing, it simply has to be completely believable to the person who's receiving.
Well, you know, I have a proposal in to do a 5-hour special all about her work and her life. Since we recently passed, I find it so hard to believe, the 10th anniversary of her death.
Yeah.
As far as we know, as far as I know, and Sheree Renee Thomas looked it up and so forth, I did the very last interview with her.
Well, quite possible.
Which is really annoying. And we cut it short. We stopped at about 45 minutes for what would have been a 2-hour show because she was feeling a bit of vertigo. And it was the vertigo.
Ultimately, that caused the fall.
She was carrying groceries up newly poured cement, which she paid for with her MacArthur Genius Grant. She was a large woman. She was a tall woman. And that killed her at age 55.
Yeah.
One of the things, I mean, this is one of the most horrible things that if you were a writer trying to eck out the worst things that you could end a story with, you would put in there is that she said during that final interview, she had writer's block for about 10 years at that point.
And
Fledgling had just come out. And she didn't think it was her best work of all time.
Her getting back into her work.
I thought it was decent. But her worst stuff is better than a lot of people's best stuff.
Exactly.
But what she said was it had opened the dam. The writer's block was over, and she had an idea for a fabulous new series. Now, you know, that's like the thing that you put into a movie to crush people's hearts.
Well, I remember reading the Orton Diaries, and it's the honest experience because you know Joe Orton's story. You know that he was killed by his lover, Halliwell. There was evidently a cocktail in London for some time called Halliwell's Hammer. Which shows the perverse humor of the British. But you read the book, and it's fascinating because, A, it's well written. It's Joe Orton, and it's his diary, and it's his language, and his tone of voice. And
for those people who don't know Joe Orton, look him up. He's well worth it.
Yeah, and it tracks the arc of his success, of his relationship with Halliwell, but all at the beginning and the establishment of the relationship, but also his success, you know, meeting the Beatles, working in all these movies, and it hits this soaring moment, this crescendo of promise, and then it stops because that night Halliwell bashed his head in with a hammer.
Yeah.
And it was like, whoa, and it's those moments that are weirdly ironic. I mean, you know, on the other extreme, though, I mean, you have the end of someone like Sir Neil Hurston, who had enormous success, fell out of grace, went into obscurity, dies poor and alone, forgotten in Florida. I mean, which would you prefer? You know, to burn out at the peak of your power and just leave a mark that's almost indelible, or to fade away into obscurity, you know, weakened and ill and living far longer than any purpose is remains? All life is ironic. All death is ironic. No death is what you want it to be at. I mean, are we going to go here?
Let's stop.
Immortality. Oh, my God. No, let's stop that.
And I will point out, by the way, that April 16th is Margot Adler's birthday.
So. I've been reading the e-book on I downloaded it when it came out on the Vampire's thing that was on Amazon. And I've been reading it in the last couple of weeks, and I was like, oh, it's just the entire book. I thought this was just an answer. But it's, God, it makes you miss her ever so much more. It is so smart. It is so fascinating. It is so perceptive.
It is,
and
she was.
And just as, even as simply as a treatise on death and the perception of death in America, the irony that her husband feared death more than anything, lived his life in perfect health, and then was just grabbed. I mean, it was like, whoa.
You know he worked for Barbara, right?
Vaguely remember that. Yeah, I'm very, you know, my brain doesn't hold these things.
Yeah.
I have to have narrative or I can't. I mean,
no, he was within the family, somewhere in the 1970s.
Yeah, no, and so was Margaret. Yeah, exactly. But I mean, but look, it's lovely to hear her voice again. It reminds me that I have video of the Last Vampire reading we did at NERSIP with her that I have to cut down, as well as the Beyond Blackula evening, which I just couldn't even look at
with
for 2 years
Banks,
after Leslie died.
I mean, my God.
Oh, yeah.
We have these wonderful people, two of the stars of that show are gone.
Yeah. And I want
L.A. Banks and Margot Adler.
Yeah. Well, separate events. And I've got to get them both together and cut down and organized for just so it could be posted for
people.
Who are
the four? I remember there was a live.
Beyond Blackula was Alina.
Linda Addison, yourself.
Linda Addison,
and
me,
Banks.
And Leslie.
Yeah.
And it was so funny.
I guess it was.
Oh, my God. It brings back memories. Okay, so.
Let's talk about living people or something.
Well, no, but this is a funny story.
Okay, go ahead.
And it's the reason that and the ultimate point of the story is that everything happens for a purpose. So I was curating the Beyond Blackula reading, which was going to be basically modern black vampire writing. You know, after Beyond Blackula fell in as the title because it was perfect. I mean, it was after that 70s movie, which are actually both of them are quite good. He does a brilliant performance. They're plausible in premise. They are actually very well directed. There's a wonderful satiric humor to them both. I actually highly recommend both Blackula and Screen Blackula Screen. So we did this. So I had contacted everyone they wanted to be in it. And everything was set. And then Leslie, you know, calls me up and she's like, oh, I'm in Philly. Do I have to come to New York? Is there some way I can do this without coming to New York? And I'm like, I mean, if it's impossible. I mean, I could conceivably come there and videotape you and then play that at the event. That wouldn't be the same thing, but let's talk about that. Well, I don't know how she finds out, but Alia hears this. And I was like, well, wait a minute. That's an option. I could be a video. I'm like, okay, wait a minute. I said, I'm not spending an evening sitting in a room with video monitors. No, I'm nipping this in the butt. So I called Leslie back, and I was like, okay, what's going on? Are you really ill or something, or is it a real problem, or is it just... What is it? And she's like, it's the time. It's also the money. I mean, I can't. I said, I'll buy your ticket. I said, I will pay your way. I said, if that's an issue, that's not a problem. I completely understand. And she was like, oh, damn. It's like, yes, my last excuse. I can't really validate. She's like, okay. I said, please. Because, I mean, I said, it won't be the same thing without you, which it wouldn't have been. I mean, Leslie was like the queen of black vampire writers and still is. I mean, you know, and she's Leslie. And it was great because everyone in New York got to come down, and my God, her piece turned out, and it was a fantastic event. The room was packed, and she just said these amazing things, and I got like 2-3 cameras videotaping all this. I got Karen from the block.
You came with every piece of video equipment you had.
Everything I had, and I still didn't shoot it the way I wanted. I looked at the footage, and it's like, God damn it, but I can play with it in post, and I can fix it up, and the audio is good. And but I've got to make that available. I want people to be able to see what she had to say, but also Linda. And I even did a decent job in there, so I don't know if I think I did a bit of a reading. But then the other event is the Margot Vampire Night, which was, I don't remember who the other reader was of that. Was that the night that Ashley read for somebody else? Was that another night?
Clay and Susan Griffith. Were
reading
from their Vampire Empire
series. Yeah, that's right. But that should be cut together, too, because, again, you know, they were all great, but especially because of Margot, you know, not being around.
And we had that, she did a short version of her Why Vampires Are Important.
Yeah,
all that sounded something like this.
So in the beginning, I pondered mortality.
So, yeah, it was something like that.
Yeah.
I don't travel without that. I don't travel without that?
That voice. Well, you know, it's, I don't know. I've gotten so increasingly Buddhist. I'm now actually editing video for a Buddhist institute up in Massachusetts, doing class things. And I gave them a very low regional rate. If it's as simple as it should be, it's fine in quantity. But the advantage is I'm getting to hear all their lectures that they're putting up as coursework that they're selling as classes online. I can actually get the benefit of for as part of the job of putting it together. And I have interest in finding out more on the subject and getting deeper into it. I still think the Tao is the only thing that really actually plausibly explains the nature of the universe and our place in it.
Well,
and it's immediately metaphysical, and it immediately makes the whole universe supernatural. So
well, you've
no
met
one wants
Catherine
to hear,
Davis, you know, who was on before me and put you on the air without me.
Yeah, I heard a little bit of what you were saying.
I mean,
on
you
the,
need
on
to
land,
talk to her about this kind of spiritualism. She teaches Qigong, and I've very seriously been thinking I could use less stress in my life. I might take that up. Maybe
well,
you
know,
too.
it's. I mean, I'm sitting in my hammock chair more because I'm sorry, I could be sitting in my hammock chair now. My God, what am I doing?
She by the way, I believe, is helping Matt Levine with his back problems. That's a Brooklyn Commons thing. This is the tech for downstairs at 388.
Mm-hmm.
So, just saying.
Well, you know,
we should get back on a broader topic, though.
Okay.
And I'm really trying to remember what it was.
I can tell you exactly what it was. The cliffhanger I left you at the end of the last episode?
Yes.
I don't remember what triggered it, but we were talking about something that was in the series of Young Girl Fighting the Evil Empire movies that were coming out based on the many series of YA novels of Young Girls Fighting the Evil Empire story.
Right.
Hunger Games, you know, the fifth.
Which I finally
something.
Saw the last episode of the movie and read the book.
I've only seen the first movie, and at some point, I suppose, should, if nothing else, is research and watch the rest.
You know, I've got to say, I thought the second movie was going to be problems with the second film, and I didn't even want to watch the first movie. I thought, oh, here we are, it's a YA thing, this is for teenage girls, and blah, 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 and instead, I encountered what I thought was one of the better science fiction films of the last few years.
Well, yeah, as it basically ripped off one of the better Japanese science fiction films of
which
years
is that?
Before it. I now, of course, will not be able to remember the name, but it's essentially
where
students are sent away to an island and they are forced to kill each other.
But that's merely where it starts. Okay.
Yeah.
Because by the time it's done, there's an international social revolution.
Oh, yeah, no, exactly. Okay, but listen to what the point that I was making last time.
Yeah.
Is that we have an issue. There's been so much in the news about these adolescent girls leaving England, parts of Europe and America to go join ISIS.
Right.
That are like attracted to the allure of the rebel and all of this. And I said, have we been indoctrinating our young people into believing in this kind of a revolution? Because that's what they've been watching and reading for the last 20 years. That almost all these novels, because one becomes successful, as there are many Harry Potter imitations, there are many imitations of Hunger Games, there are many, you know, that go, I mean, but there are so many adolescent girls fighting the, I mean, and it started with Princess Leia in Star Wars. What was she but a young woman fighting the evil empire?
I'm not saying that we've done this, but it's not
surprising to me that young women find an allure in this. We're trying to figure out, why are they doing this? Are they out of their minds? Well, you look at the material we've been giving them for the last decade, it makes them perfectly accessible to that headset. So it's an interesting question in my mind.
Well,
are we somehow laying the groundwork for this?
First of all, I think, you know, the claiming yourself as a power as a young woman, I think, really goes back as far as media is concerned to Buffy.
Well, yeah, and she's fighting evil. But it shifted from that to the specific anti-evil empire thing at the point. There's more of the point that I'm making.
Yeah.
That ordinary girls getting out there, picking up guns, getting on camouflage gear, you know, they can go out there and they can save the world. And I'm not saying they can't. I think that's a really positive model to have. But I just find it interesting that suddenly some of them are actually trying to do it, except that they're going to the wrong side. And yeah. I think that they should stay at home and, like, get involved in politics and vote to get someone other than Trump into the White House. And a lot of them are. You know, but I just found an interesting corollary. I'm not saying it's a causality or a correlative, but, you know, it was just an interesting, like, discuss, you know, throw it on the floor. If we were doing a call-in show, I'm sure we could get a rousing round of responses to that question from varying points of view. But I found it interesting after, like, I sat there one week. There was a week where the new Hunger Games movie was coming out. No, because I have a 2:30. There was the Hunger Games came out, and then there was the fifth wave came out the same week, and it was like, and every time I looked up at the TV, there was an adolescent girl in, like, you know, combat gear with a big ass gun on her shoulder, racing through the woods and blowing people away, and it was like, wow, this is, looks awfully glamorous and fun. If I was 17 and I was looking at, I'd be sort of curious. I don't know. The reality of it's very dark. I read a piece in the Times about these 5 girls in Syria who are basically being forced married off to members of ISIS, each of whom basically at some point come home to find out their husband's gone off on a suicide bombing mission and hasn't come back, and didn't discuss it with them, didn't mention it, and they're going to be married off to the next guy because they need their guys to have a little home life when they're not out, you know, blowing up empires or anything. So there is no great glamour to it. Anyone should, in our country, young people of any gender thinking that this is a lovely, fun thing are just way going to be below their comfort level. I mean, I had a friend whose son, like, was dating a young woman from that, Palestine, it was more like Iraq, and he just vanished. I mean, he followed her across the ocean and never came back, and we'll never know what happened. And we don't know if it's a recruitment thing or what. You just don't know.
Yeah.
They've got that weird new CSI show. CSI Scared American is what they should call it. Because it's basically like, you know, they're investigating what horrible things happening to Americans all over the world. Tonight was Japan. And there was some guy who was like, you know, this crazy Japanese guy who was murdering all these people because he had was the most surface, plastic, skewed vision of Japanese culture I've seen since, like, that movie they did with, like, you know, what was it, Sean Connery and Wesley Snipes or something?
Oh,
I don't know.
Whatever
that was. It wasn't Wesley Snipes. It was, like, Michael Douglas or something. But it's like, oh,
no,
God, are we going to trot out every tired cliche from
a...
Oh, well, and as was, you know, this. It was just getting so ridiculous. I mean, the series is, last week it was Middle Europe. I mean, you know, people being, you know, oh, but it's, oh my God, it's just, it's funny as hell on one level. But it's like, you know, Americans are afraid enough to have, I mean, they're not going to Europe anymore because they're afraid of getting blown up. They're certainly not going to the Middle East. You know, so, I mean, you know, there's so many, I mean, I hear that tourism has dropped radically, that Americans are just afraid to go anywhere. Which, when you think about how much people hate America around the country in certain areas, yeah, it kind of makes sense. But it's a shame because we need to get outside of America. We need to see what the world is like so we can see the privilege and advantages we have here. I mean, we really do have the best ride. And, you know, I think I appreciated it more as a kid because I grew up, you know, first grade, fourth grade in Europe, and I traveled around Italy and got to see other places and then lived around America, not just in New York, but Ohio, Texas, Virginia. You know, I really got a good sense of this country. You know, I cannot think of anywhere else I would live and would like to live more. I want us to be better than we are right now, but it still is the end game for me. I mean, America is you know, I love it. You know, I freaking love it. America made me. You know, I wouldn't exist if it wasn't for me. In all my positive and
negative
aspects.
Well, most of us wouldn't.
Absolutely. I mean,
come from
a Holocaust family,
so
absolutely. That got here and reformed themselves. I mean, that's why I get tired of all the anti-immigration speak, because it does get very. This country is built by immigrants coming to reinvent themselves. America is where you can reinvent yourself.
Yeah, but
my God.
But a few, you know, two generations after. if that far.
They put down the pike staffs, and it's like, keep them out, keep them out.
Exactly.
It's ironic. It's
exactly.
Very funny. It's ironic. It's
you
ironic.
Know, first but, let's kill all the indigenous people and then say, I came over on the Mayflower.
Well, you know, listening to Cruz talk about immigration, it's like, are you kidding me? Do you not, you know, have you no backwards vision whatsoever? Do you not understand anything your family has ever told you about how they got here? Do you have any clues what you're talking about? Anyway. But
I can answer that, by the way. No.
Yeah, obviously not. So I'm sitting here in my hammock chair in front of a 32-inch Samsung screen that has a burning log on it. I've got this fireplace loose.
You've got
it's
that
just,
up again.
I put it on when I have the write-ins here. When I have the writing group of the write-ins, I have a little hearth in the log that just hangs
well,
there.
Well, we have to explain to that. You have two things going on there. One is that you host a writer's group, the Tabula Rasa group.
Yes, which Bob is a member of.
At least, yes, which at least one. We had a few people at the reading last night from there. And
yes.
The other thing you do is you provide, I don't know what to call it, a haven?
Well, it's a write-in. Well, a Tempest and...
A write-in is a good term for it.
That's
you remember
what
I've
just started
folk.
Calling it, you know, it's like, let's give it a 60-50 sort of feeling. But
it's
separately,
a happening. It's a writer's happening.
Yes, but it's a writer's space more than anything else. I mean, what used to happen was Chris Dykman would get together with people at Tea Lounge, which it actually reopens. We actually got together with her and Danielle and a couple other people there last Saturday. But Tempest also had Vagabond, and she would gather friends to go sit. And Rick Bowes made it really clear that this is how you kill a cafe, that you don't invite 10 people to come there and buy a cup of coffee and write for 3 hours, that is how you kill a cafe.
Well, that's
and we were horrified because it never occurred to anybody. I mean, we were buying buns and sandwiches, and I would actually try to buy a lunchy thing, you know. But, you know, if you're there more than 2 hours, that's a lot of more things they could be selling in that time than you're eating. It was like, oh, we're so sorry. We drove two cafes out of
business. When a very famous coffee company started up in Seattle, they did, and were spreading out to the rest of the world, they did studies on how do you make people feel welcome long enough to have their coffee and a sandwich or something. But
and
not long enough to sit there for the only, you know, because in order to use the Wi-Fi for the rest of the day.
Right. Because that's what killed.
And so they actually, it is said, I don't have firsthand knowledge, but I've heard it said by reliable sources, that they actually chose chairs that are perfectly fine, but after a while you just have to get up.
Oh, I can believe it. I mean, McDonald's
absolutely believe it.
Used to be done in these hideous orange and yellow colors to drive people out. I mean, so they would eat that food and get the hell out. And now they've got this little McDonald's around the corner for me on 9th Street that has gone. They've changed with the menu. So as they got salads and tried to get greener and seem more healthy, it went woody. And it got much more inviting. It became a cafe. And it was like, no, come hang and have free Wi-Fi and eat McDonald's all day. So they're sort of reversing that. They're trying to slide more into that Starbucks window of like keep them there for 20 to 30 minutes, but not 3 hours.
Yeah.
So at any rate, the bottom line is for a while these were all gone, and I missed them. I had gone to one or two, and it was like a really nice thing because we were all convened. People would chat a bit, then they would write. We all break off, stop chatting after 10. After we catch up quickly, we all sort of go off to separate corners and write. And then after like about half an hour, 45 minutes, there's like a sort of, whoa, where's that more caffeine? You know, there's a little 5-minute break, a little chat, then back into it. And it gets a nice rhythm.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're there, there's a certain pressure to not be sitting there staring at a wall. And if two people start chatting too long, everyone starts looking at them like, why aren't you running? You know? So it becomes a very productive time. So I have a big space. I mean, I'm blessed with that, thank God. I did what I did in the 80s that provided me with that space. But because it's comfortable now, and I started doing the writing group meetings here after we lost our space in Midtown, because one of our members providing it dropped out, it was like, wow, there's enough room for like, 5 to 10 people will sit here and comfortably and write. So,
and now there's a writer's group on the second floor here at 388 Atlantic. I helped guide them to it.
Yeah, which is a lovely thing because it's like, but it's nice. It's a nice thing to.
And there is Wi-Fi in a cafe here, and it's very comfortable to spend quite a bit of time.
And they can run downstairs and grab coffee and bring it back upstairs.
Exactly.
But but there's a nice. Not everybody can write in a group. Not everybody's comfortable writing in a public space like that. Rick is like, nope, sorry, not interested. Don't do it. Not my process. And I understand that, you know. But I defend everything in my life. With early time New York Times articles, like when William Styron died, he evidently keeps my same sleeping schedule of sleeping till noon, getting up during correspondence, starting to work in the early evening, and then staying up through 3 a.m. to write. And I said, see, I'm not crazy. He did it too, goddammit. So it's fine.
Well,
articles on maps and things, but I found an article on distraction that said working at a cafe actually is a good thing.
Well, let me tell you something. When Margot Adler started this radio program in 1972 as 5 to 7 a.m., the very first week that she did that, you know, starting at 5 a.m., she said, okay, it's 5 a.m. Who's out there? What are you doing? And the number of people was amazing. How many people were artists or writers?
Oh, yeah.
Who, you know, had been basically working through till about 5:30 and then they would have had whatever freeform program was on BAI before that. And then when Margot came on, it provided them that break they needed. Some of them went
the
back to sleep and some of them worked in the, you know, in the morning.
It's the wind down.
I'm sorry, say again?
I was going to say it's the wind down. It's stimulating enough that it picks you, it grabs your thing, your brain coming off an artistic jag, which is what that is. I've done that often myself. I love working at night. No one's going to call me except you, of course, and bother me while I'm trying to get work done.
Even then, and I try to limit it to about 11 or midnight, you know.
There you go. There's certain key hours, and at least you call ahead. But I still feel like, I mean, when you called earlier, it was like, God, this is like those, like, little text messages from, like, you know, that guy you don't see except when he wants to get laid. And it's like, hey, what's up? You up? It's like, you know, it's like, really, Jim, you think I don't know why you're calling me on a Wednesday night at this hour? I know what you're up to. Don't think you're kidding me. And anyway, where were we? We were talking about the joys of...
I was actually getting the point of the joys of the night people.
Yes.
And
but
and there's a point I wanted to make.
I live in
that. Which is, this is a very special time of day. This is something that... not so much the other Pacifico radio stations, but that WBAI always had, and it's becoming, alas, a bit more rare, the concept of the free-form spot, the place of personal mind journey, the life of the mind, as Larry Josephson used to call it, where, and don't forget, we used to have Alan Watts on this radio station discussing all of this stuff. And he was on All Pacifica, but BAI was one of his points of origin. And the thing that people can do, even at this very hour in New York, I know some of our listeners, it's morning. And I mean, the sun's up and everything, but here it's 2:26. And it's an amazing time of day. For personally, I preferred 5 a.m., but for its stillness. That's why, by the way, in case people don't know, it's called Hour of the Wolf. Hour of the Wolf is that time of day between dawn and night. It's an ancient tradition. Veronica Sheenis told me it's Vargtimen.
Well,
that's actually what it's
the
called.
Worst thing in the world to go to bed on a full stomach because God knows it's going to give you acid reflux in a second. there are very few things more satisfying than working through the night on something that you're just so creatively driven by that you can work on it all night and you don't want to stop. And just hitting that point of closing where it's like, okay, now I can walk away from it. Just as the sun is peeping through the blinds, and it's like, you know, right now I need like a big honking breakfast and then go to bed. And you just make, I did that like a couple weeks ago. I just worked through the night on this thing for Invisible Universe because it was just, I was in the zone and it was just, I had this vision of it in my head and it just, it's like, I just need to keep going. If I can just keep, I can get it just right. And I finished it. I output, I watched it like 15 times and then like made myself this wonderful like big breakfast. Egg of eggs and toasted, just like climbed into the bed. Slept like the dead. But that's, I mean, I that was life in the 80s. I mean, we all lived it. We all like, you know, I mean, there were a lot of nights where like painters,
well,
and writers, we would go out clubbing in the early, we'd go out and have drinks, have dinner, get together for dinner and drinks, go crash for a couple hours, take a disco nap, get up, go out midweek to like a club at like midnight, party for a couple of hours. And at the point they're starting to throw us out between 3 and 4, you go home and you start working. People start painting.
Well, let
people
me
start
ask
writing.
You,
you know, it was the best. It was best.
Now you spent 20 of those years in L.A. working as a producer.
Ten, Jesus God, don't double.
And
ten.
How different?
91 to 2000.
How different was the culture? That kind of culture we're talking about here. Did that exist at all there?
Yes. I mean, I can't completely discount any artistic part or life in Los Angeles. It's smaller pockets. It's spread out wider. It, in odd ways, I was out there from 91 to 2001, and I imagine in the last 10, 15 years, things have changed, partly because rents were going up even as I was leaving. It used to be, like, really cheap. I mean, my God, the 90s in L.A. were nothing like the 90s in New York, because the rents were shooting up in New York in the 90s. Tenant who was only paying like $600 a month, who was like so grateful she moved out and moved her friend in and started charging her $800 a month. So I found that out pretty much 2 months in and said, no, just send me that check directly. But at any rate, in the same way that the pricing in Manhattan and my area and the surrounding areas, commutable to Wall Street around Jersey Shore and all these areas, mm-hmm. have priced out the artistic scene, they're pushed out to like Crown Heights to Bushwick, Williamsburg was always one, but that's wildly pricey. But there's a ring of culture around New York now. And what's happened is people have realized they don't need to commute 2 hours to go to a club. They can create their own scene out there. And so when you go out to these areas and you go out to Greenpoint, you find like all these fascinating little bars and restaurants. It's like, oh my God, you don't actually have to leave the neighborhood to have a good time. And that was sort of what the L.A. art scene was like. There were areas like, you know, Venice at the time, now, my God, I mean, I went there and it's basically a shopping strip. And any, there's a few necromancers still there. But other than that, it was like, wow, this is just another sun-bleached strip. But at the time, you know, Venice had much more of a had retained more of its personality as a small artsy community. And there were pockets like that all over Los Angeles. But to a large degree, the nature of L.A. was very different because, first of all, bars close at 4 a.m. in New York. They close at, I think, 1 a.m. in L.A.
Mm.
It wasn't even 2. It was, like, early.
So you
it
don't like have that same night scene in the same way.
And I was convinced, and I have no verification of this, but I was convinced it was because it was a studio town. And the studios ran L.A. at a certain point in its history.
Well,
and they didn't want their crews staggering into work at 5, 6 a.m. off of 2 at the bars. So they closed those bars early enough that these guys had to get drunk and get home. They couldn't buy any liquor after 1 o'clock because they had to be on set at 5 a.m. So it's really strange that a city as large as L.A. has such an urban curfew for booze. But it's a studio town, and it made sense. So I was
and
like, okay,
of
I'll
a
bet
lot of
you.
Alcoholics in it.
Yes. And the business has a lot of alcoholics in it because it's highly stressful because they got you there at 5 a.m. So you can go home and drink, but you're not going out to drink because social drinking burns itself. It feeds itself. You get a bunch of guys together, they're going to drink longer and more than they would if they're home alone with a bottle. They'll pass out faster. They'll just knock it in and they're out. So at any rate, that was one of the things that was interesting. But the thing is, when I first moved out there in 91, I'd spent a month out there, went to a little red car, a little sports car, you fall in love in L.A. in May in a convertible sports car. It's green. It's beautiful. The music's playing. And you're seduced. You unpack everything up. You move out there in June. Summer hits. Everything dries out. The hills start burning. I mean, there was literally a day I was walking the dog. I was living in Atwater Village, sharing a house with this woman whose boyfriend had moved out. She needed a roommate to pay the rent on the house. It was a perfect arrangement. We got along, nice little house. I'm walking her dog one day because she taught, so I was there all day riding with her dog. And I picked the dog out, and as I'm walking back to the house, I look up, and Griffith Park was like a stone's throw away, and the hill was on fire. It was just, and it was weird because I was like, huh, that mountain looks like it's on fire. It can't be. And it was. And in seconds, I hear helicopters coming in because the fire, you know, people with dumpy helicoptery things come in. And it was weird because you're watching it. And it's like footage of a volcano running in reverse because the fire is going up. It's not rolling down from the top of the mountain. It's going up to the top of the mountain. And it was big. It was a big fire. It hit a big swath. And it was like, whoa. And it's like, do I go back in the house and wait for like this to end? Do I sit out here and watch it and see if I should be getting in my car and fleeing with a dog? But that was L.A. It was like this weird weather thing. And every year they'd be like, mudslides, the mountains are burning. And it's like, that's what they do. They have done this for billions of years before you lived in this area. Why did you build a house that you a place where you know this happens every year?
One of my favorite early Pacifica radio shows was, I don't remember who did it, but in the early 70s, there was a fellow, a team. There were two people, I think a man and a woman, who basically got out their tape recorders and went down to a southernmost point in the U.S. of the San Andreas Fault and drove north as close to the fault as they could. And whenever they found a house, preferably a private house, on or next to the fault, they would get out and they would talk to the people and they would say, you're aware that there's this thing over here, right?
This and is where the state's falling into the ocean?
It made the prices. We got such a deal on this house.
Well, but, you know, the gamble's kind of paid off.
It's like, oh, you know, you can also get a nice deal on Mount St. Helens.
That's very true. I'm sure the gardening is incredible because that lava leaves the ground so fertile.
Well, yeah.
You'd have a lawn to die for in Mount St. Helens.
But you really had people who were just thinking in terms of, let's go to we can buy this place cheap because it's on the bleeping San Andreas Fault.
I knew people who moved to 9/11 after the bombing. I mean, I went to a party I came back to New York 2 weeks after 9/11 happened, and it was still burning for like another month or two after
home. We were already there, man. We were on 120 Wall Street. We were five blocks away.
Yeah,
our rent went down.
No.
It was good.
Well, but that was the thing I was going to say. So I went to a party one night that someone invited me to, and it was on the in that Battery Park development that overlooked the towers.
Yeah.
And, you know, when you look out the window, there was the big hole that, you know, had been the Twin Towers, that at that point, by then, they were excavating and they were starting to clear it. It wasn't smoldering anymore, which it was for quite a while after I returned.
Yes.
But it was like, what the hell? And it was like the rent is insanely low because they were doing deals like crazy. People were fleeing that area like locusts in reverse. And there were all these deals. They were giving bonuses to move into this place. I think the guy got $5,000 from the building. Not only did they have a reduced rent, they gave him a bonus to move in. They were incentivizing the best they could. They were trying to salvage something. I don't know what the intent was to prove to people it was still okay. But, I mean, at the time, they were still testing the atmosphere in Ground Zero.
Yeah.
They were still not sure you should be breathing the air down there because there was a lot of stuff that burned and shouldn't be burned that had gone into the air that hadn't quite blown out yet.
When I was, here, when I was here, there being 120 Wall Street, and 3 weeks later, I was breathing Soylent Green.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Don't even go there. Yeah, don't even go there. I mean, I remember that I forgot until the oh, here's a quick question. Someone keeps asking. What are people calling? Are people in New York calling this the World Trade Center or the Freedom Tower? How are New Yorkers referring to the new construction? Do you know that?
I believe that.
And I said, I've not heard anyone actually refer to it, so I don't actually know. Okay. But I did see a news thing where they referred to it as the World Trade Center.
I believe I know the answer to this.
Yes.
I believe that the building itself is the Freedom Tower, and that the area that,
that is part of
the
a complex
and, right, that, and
that forms the World Trade Center.
Exactly.
Even as the original was.
Exactly.
And with the Twin Towers in the World Trade Center.
Right.
Okay,
the
that makes perfect
sense.
It
was not called the World Trade Center.
Yes.
The area was.
It was the area, that block of buildings was the World
exactly.
Trade Center.
Exactly. That
makes perfect
true.
Sense. That makes perfect sense. That's the answer I have to give him, because that makes sense. So the Freedom Tower is a part of the World Trade Center, but that whole complex is viewed as a single unit called the World Trade Center.
Yeah.
Yes, that makes perfect sense. Anyway, that's what we're talking
about. If you look at Google Maps, it will show that.
Yes, I'm sure. I was looking at Google Maps today, and they have this, like, 3D tilt view thing that you can sort of scroll across that looks like you're flying over 3D buildings.
Yeah,
because
Microsoft did that first on Bing, but then...
No, I'm strolling up Fourth Avenue.
Google did it better.
I'm strolling up Fourth Avenue looking for this vitamin store that obviously is in a building that was not in existence when they were doing Street View, because there's a big hole in construction site. So I imagine I just have to bike down there and see if there's vitamin stores there, though I don't need to. I got the vitamins I needed. At any rate, I'm scrolling down Fourth Avenue, and suddenly the top of the Williamsburg Bank building just rolls up on the bottom of the screen, and I'm like hovering over it by about 100 feet. And it's huge, and it's like right there at the dome, and I'm looking at it from overhead. And I got to say, impressive. I was like, sweet. I just pushed it back, and I sort of, you couldn't quite get into midair and move around it. It's like you could sort of get this tilt view and go back and forth beyond it, or you could sort of see it flat on, but you can't quite navigate it in quite the way you want to, which is to fly around the Williamsburg Bank building. But it was a fascinating thing. I spent the rest of the afternoon for that hour trying to figure out software that would let me, like, do pans across Google Street View scenes or this overhead view to capture as video for films or something. But and found a few sort of things.
I actually have a reasonable idea how to do that.
Well, we will chat off the air about that.
Yes, yes.
You have to show me that.
It is the same way, now they've changed the algorithm for live stream, that I am going to capture in lower res. You know, it won't be 720, but I can capture last night's reading that way.
Yes, well, that's very nice. You'll have
to
start bringing a drive, because we are capturing it to a hard drive there. So you'll have to start bringing a drive we can copy it to.
Yeah, we'll do that. We'll do that for a few of them.
Because as long as you can get it easily, but, you know, getting stream video is never...
Yeah, but it's also... Yeah, but I'd rather get the higher res version all that.
Yeah.
I may be in this neighborhood actually Monday afternoon.
Yeah, and bring a big one, because there's a bunch of them there.
I have to get them all
before they burn.
I have a 4 terabyte drive.
Yeah, so no, I'm just saying, you know.
I just don't want to carry that every month.
No, but if you go and you grab it all that's there now on that drive, you can... bringing a smaller drive to transfer things back and forth between that isn't as large. So that power is within your capacity. I mean, you're giving me the one from January on our flash drive, for goodness sake.
Yeah, that's true. Oh, one second. Let's see who this is. Yellow. Let me try that. Hello? Yeah, somebody calls the what we call the hotline, you know, which actually rings in the control room.
Okay.
And there was nobody there, although I suspect it was Max.
Max likes to do prank calls?
Max likes
to test the phone line.
Max likes to give me information about what I need to be doing when I'm doing it wrong.
So So you're doing something wrong then?
I don't know.
Interesting.
But I wouldn't be surprised.
I wouldn't either, considering how the show began tonight.
I'm sorry, I should be calling to say, oh, we've got to put a different program on after Lister. But
it could be almost anything.
So I wanted to ask you, getting back to the topic from 2 weeks ago.
Yes, now that you've squeezed me past the limit.
Yeah, I knew it would happen. I knew it would happen.
Yeah, of course you did, you scum.
Yeah, well, watch it. Uh-oh. Okay,
you swine?
Somebody wants to talk on the air. I don't want to disconnect you. If I disconnect you, call back. Okay?
Okay.
Let me see if I can do this.
I hear a little noise.
Wait. There's the other line. Again. Hello. Hello. Anybody there? Yes. Okay, you're calling on the wrong line. Bye. It was a listener. It wasn't Max at all. It was a listener.
Ah, well, there we go. Someone's listening. It's so nice.
Well,
there's something wrong with the phone system here.
I
was waiting for the police to call. The call's coming from inside the building.
Yeah. Well, yes, right. Exactly. So, question. The Magicians, have you watched any of it? Have you read it?
No, because I have the book is actually in the stack of books I have to read that I'm reviewing in Fantastic Stories, plugged for my it's bi-monthly issues. So I have a regular column now. We'll see how lucky it goes before they kick me out. But I'm doing a column called Read Me, in which I'm attempting to go through the literally 3-foot stack of books that I've been training to read. And no, but I'm answering your question because The Magicians is in that stack. I got it when Lev actually did Nurses, and it's probably signed. Actually.
Wow, that's about 4 years ago.
Yes, and I've been trying to get to it for 4 years. I mean, this stack of books is insane. So the reality of getting a paid column it gives me amazing incentive to actually read the book. So I wanted to ask you about it because... So I haven't watched the series except for the first episode. Because I want to read the book first.
Okay, no, I understand that. Now, I've read the book first.
Yeah.
I read only about half of the second book when 3 weeks ago Lev was here. And I have been following the TV show. And I am just... the two of them are totally different from each other and totally the same.
Well, you were discussing the folding in of the second book into the first book.
Yes, exactly. But I also wanted to discuss, and this is actually where I started the thing I wanted to talk about 2 weeks ago. There's a new form of extended television, of storytelling, that, for example, Ridley Scott has been doing with The Man in the High Castle.
Mm-hmm.
And what they're doing is if you watch that series, you will recognize it as being, yeah, absolutely, this is The Man in the High Castle by Philip K. Dick, which you cannot do if you watch Blade Runner and say, okay, I read Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep. But what he has done is he's taken the universe of Philip K. Dick, he's taken the universe of The Man in the High Castle, and he has a totally, totally different story going on there. And it's a valid one. Mm. It's a good one. Although I caught a really nasty bit in there that, you know, it simply has to do with, okay, this guy is going west. He's an agent for the Nazis who are running the U.S. There are differences between the book and the TV series that say, wait a minute, he doesn't have to go west. He doesn't need to do it. But that's something else. The point is the form is a totally different form where they've created the universe and they're using the universe faithfully and telling a totally new story.
Well, but I mean, there's precedent for that in a lot of the adaptations of comic books to series on TV and stuff. I mean, where I'll sit there watching something and going, well, this isn't quite I kind of forget. I mean, at its
best. Well, yeah, but that's a different kind of thing.
It's when you're talking about where you're essentially managing to encapsulate the reality of it so much that you can vary the narrative because it's true enough to the universe that it feels valid.
Yeah, but the
it's worse. It's like
novel,
we bought the name and we don't care what you think about anything. We just bought the name to get you in here. Now we're going to do whatever we feel like. It's sort of what I felt like Constantine got to a certain degree.
Yeah, but you see, a comic book is different because a comic book is basically nothing but world building, and then they'll go to another world when they feel like it. Whereas we're talking with The Man in the High Castle about a novel.
Well, first of all, having read about 300 issues of Constantine and now seeing it as a giant single narrative, I would disagree somewhat with your dismissal of comic book narrative in that
I'm
narrative.
Not dismissing
sir,
it. I'm saying
sir,
that it's simply world building.
No, it's not. It's about character as well. Read 300 issues of Hellblazer and tell me it's just about world building. It's about character arc as well. And that's what's come into comics since the 90s more than previously.
Yeah,
the problem
like
I'm having now with Marvel and the whole Battle World thing is that, yes, it's been reduced to world building. They've lost any aspect of characters. We're just so busy juggling all these frickin' elements of collapsing the multiverse to try and get rid of it. So, yes, it's been reduced to world building in the last few years.
Okay, but
it reached a point beyond that.
But this,
that I find it interesting that this, I think that it's interesting because what it does do successfully, if it works, is it gives people who have read a work something other than the literal representation of it in pictures and sound that aren't going to match up to their own internal perception of it. We all imagine a book when we read it in a certain way. We cast it on our heads. We see it in a certain way. And the issue that movies had for years was that they could never match up to the wonder that was in our head when we read the book. Well, once we went CGI, their big brag was that they were more imaginative than we were, which is all bull stuff.
Yeah.
Bull stuff. But the thing is that what they realize is, okay, we don't need to try and outdo their imagination. But what we can do is augment what they've read by giving them a new experience from something that they enjoy that's still true to the thing that they enjoy.
Yeah.
And that's what the best adaptations do.
But,
that sounds like what you're describing.
You know, for a great example is Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell. Which
I didn't read the book of, though. I actually saw a copy cheap at this little discount place near me. I should have just
I have
bought,
extra
so I
copies
too many things
I
to read.
Loan you.
But the I liked the series. It sort of ended after six episodes. And I was like, oh,
seven.
So I guess this isn't seven, whatever it was. Obviously, they weren't done because they were done.
They are
did
done.
Seven
that
wrap
is
it
the
all
book.
Up?
That is the
did
book.
Seven wrap it up? My God, I only get six episodes. But the end thing that I remember was like it left it open to a lot more going on.
Well,
so
the book leaves off in a place where one has come to wound the autumnal city. The book ends in a place, a few people will get that, I know you will. The book ends in a very curious place where things go on and you know that a story continues, which does not mean that is the story. The TV series ends exactly where the book ends. And
yes.
I was,
no, and it ends in much the same way.
Very much so. It's an extremely faithful retelling and a very good one, a very well done one. And now what's about to get that same treatment is his Dark Materials by Philip Pullman.
Hmm.
And, you know, which they made the first movie attempt of with the Golden Compass, which was, you see, now the big problem with the Golden Compass is simple. It was about 90 minutes too short.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was a very faithful, very well done adaptation of the novel. There was an original screenplay that was about 4.5 hours long, and that was rejected, and then the whole thing was brought down to the final 2 hours and 20 minutes with Daniel Craig and Nicole Kidman and all that. And so, of course, it didn't work because it moved at such a rapid pace you couldn't take any of it in. It should have been...
Well, I mean, it's like, you know, the first release of Dune, which made...
Well, and that was
because
they
cut it down from like the 6 hours he shot.
Seven hours originally,
or whatever. Now, my question to you because this came up the other day, is there anywhere the intact version that he wanted?
No, they never shot it.
Oh, They only shot
it. There is a screenplay.
Oh, I read this.
There is a screenplay by Lynch.
But is there a longer version of what they did shoot, though? I mean, I thought he had like a four-hour cut from the first version.
Instead of the 220, there's a 240 or 250. And there was more that they shot, but they never did the post-production on it. So
I'm just surprised that there wasn't like Lynch being a director. I guess he walked like other projects.
No, the director is named Judas Priest. He wasn't able to use, what's the name that directors use when they walk, Alan Smithy.
He wanted
to use Alan Smithy, and for some reason the Directors Guild wouldn't let him do it, so the movie was directed by Judas Priest. David Lynch used the name Judas Priest for...
But I mean, I would have thought he might have wanted to go back and restore something.
He moved on. He didn't. He had other things.
Yeah, but he's rebooting Twin Peaks as a TV series. If anything, doesn't need to be rebooted.
Yeah, but he only did two episodes of that to begin with. People forget that you know.
No, I don't forget it. I mean, I thought he did more than two. Okay. I thought he did more than two.
Getting back to Philip.
That was
Pullman.
One of the issues I had with Twin Peaks.
Getting back to Philip Pullman, they're doing an open-ended TV series of it. Of his Dark Materials. And, here's a name that might raise your eyebrows. It's coming out of Bad Wolf Productions.
We'll never get away from it.
So that's Julie Garten. Well, there's no reason we should. It's the same producers as the people who rebooted Doctor Who.
Indeed.
So they have the right, literally, the right and the copyright and the trademark
Indeed.
To be Bad Wolf. They are Bad Wolf. I'm not talking about Russell Davis. We're talking about Julie Gardner and I forget the name of her business partner, I assume, but I don't know.
Very bad with all
the two women who... The two
I
women...
They're about my head. I don't...
Yeah, so...
Things.
They have a writer. They don't have a cast yet. It should be interesting. I implore people, before this happens... In early 2018, or maybe late 2017, during the holiday season, read the books. They are amazing.
No, I always heard good things about Pullman. There actually may be a Pullman in the house somewhere. I've got so many books in the shelf near the front window that I have to go through.
And then I would tell people, after you read the books, see the movie The Golden Compass and see what you think of the adaptation. Because I thought it was pretty darn good, except for the fact that, like, you brought him, you brought in David Lynch. It's just missing so much.
Yeah. Well, I actually read the book Dune. I'd never gotten to Dune. I don't know why it didn't cross my path when I was an adolescent male, like it, most of its readers were introduced to it. But I deliberately read it before seeing Lynch's movie Dune, because... From what I was hearing, so much had been truncated that it wasn't going to make a lick of sense to me unless I understood the complete story. And I was glad I did. I mean, it did actually make the film much more interesting to me.
He also
the movie
lynched it up. You know, he also did a, what he does with the Baron Harkonnen is very weird. Now, what Frank Herbert had done with the Baron Harkonnen, I always thought it was rather homophobic. The only thing that makes the Baron evil in the book is that, well, he's basically gay. And, and likes him young. And that's it. That's the totality of his evilness. And I think that David Lynch understood that evil had to come from a darker place than that.
Well, yes. I also think I don't think if you're getting that young, you're no longer gay, you're just a pedophile. I mean, that's the distinction that the gay community has been fighting to distinguish for some time. That
yes.
If you're screwing them young enough, it's really not to do with it being a boy. It's to do with it being a child.
Yeah, but it wasn't child. The character is played by Sting in the movie.
Sting was his nephew, Fade Rotha.
Yes, and that's the character that makes him so evil.
Yeah, but I mean, it seems to me that there were other, yes, but the thing is, that's Lynch's version. In the book,
I'm saying the book. Mm-hmm. I have the recording of me and Margo and Frank Herbert discussing this, okay?
Before
the movie came out.
One of the things I find interesting about the original Clockwork Orange is that Alex was 14. I would kind of like to have seen that movie made with a 14-year-old in that role with Kubrick. That would have been amazing.
Oh, my God, yes.
Oh, my God. It was
McDowell
it actually
did,
been true to the book.
He really did a good job with it. But Kubrick has never been that faithful to any book.
Well, Kubrick does his first. Well, Copper Crunch was the most faithful he's been. I mean, that was almost
Not The Shining, not Lolita.
No, that's what I'm saying, though, is in all of his literary adaptations, Clockwork Orange is the closest the original work he's ever come.
Yes.
The Shining movie was Stanley Kubrick's Shining. It wasn't Stephen King's Shining at all.
No,
it was a great movie. It was a dark, you know, satire on the American family, you know, as in my opinion, and it was brilliant, but it wasn't Stephen King's Shining.
Yeah.
And the same thing with, I haven't actually watched Lolita yet. I'm sort of saving it, but I've read about it extensively. And, I mean, down to the creation of Quilty, I mean, it sounds like he took his enormous liberties with that as well.
Yeah, well,
but
you will love
since he's ever making another movie, I'm waiting till I just need a Stanley Kubrick movie. I'm going to watch it that night.
You know what? Not only is it past 2:30, it's almost past 3.
I can see the thing. Well, wrap out. People should go to Fantastic Stories of the Imagination and read my column. But I have a story coming out in the next issue, and they should read the rest of the issue.
And where do they
find
it?
I've been very good
company.
Well, if you Google Fantastic Stories, you'll be able to find the site, because I would not be able to give the full link. But
that's
it's a great issue.
The sister magazine of Amazing Stories.
Indeed. Which I read as a child and is now alive again under Warren at online.
Warren Lafine, yes.
Yes, indeed. He's done a fabulous job. But I have to go back and finish reading the rest of the issue. It's a great issue. People should go look.
Okay, so everybody should go there, and we will have you back soon, no doubt. Maybe as a writer again.
Indeed, because I am writing again.
Right? You are. I'm so pleased.
Okay.
Good morning, Terrence Taylor. Thank you so much. Your website is?
TerrenceTaylor.com, or do you believe in vampires.com?
Yes, one R in Terrence.
Yes, that's why Do You Believe in Vampires.com is easier. It's easy to remember, and it takes you to the same.
Right. Okay, well, thank you.
And thank you. Enjoy the morning.
I will. Take care. Well, turned down the wrong mic. Left Terrence up. This has been Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. Thank you so much for listening. If you'd like to email me, I'm jim@ourwolf.com, H-O-U-R-W-O-L-F. You can visit me on Facebook. You can join the Hour of the Wolf group on Facebook. And most importantly, you can go see last night's fabulous, if we say so ourselves, New York Review of Science Fiction readings. We had well over 90 people there, or 90 well people there. And you can see it as if it were live from Facebook or on live stream. Stay tuned for Burn Baby Burn Clapper with Lister coming your way all too shortly. And so let me just tell you, though, people, be good to each other. We deserve it. You deserve it.
When I leave, you can remember I said with the last words on my lips that I am a revolutionary, and you're gonna have to keep on saying that. You're gonna have to say that I am a proletarian. I am
the
fixer.
The red, white, and blue spit on you.
Trying to reach my freedom of speech and expressing myself, torching the symbol of oppression. Let that be a lesson to those that want suppression of the truth. Put on hold, the bold lose control, so they force obedience. Have you pledge allegiance to a piece of cloth that's off the way I see it? Well, I'm going off berserk, cause the system works to jerk. My people, the people, all around the pig lurk. Tell me I'm wrong, or that's my right, and it's right in the Constitution. Yo, that's an illusion, huh? Suckers trying to change and rearrange. They say that I'm free, but they sure have a strange way of showing it. But I'm blowing the cover. Burn the material,
for me, but you want me in prison, cause I'm pissing your tax. The flag, I rag it and snag it and drag it and rip it to shreds, cause I'm too black, too strong, too red, too dread. And I'm dreaded cause I make the pigs tremble when I burn a symbol. Yo, I'm quick and nimble like Jack, but I'm a black man attacking the flag. I keep my torch handy, I'm no Yankee Doodle Dandy, so just hand me a flag from the fastest and watch me burn that piece of to ashes. Cause the real meaning is what the masses must learn. That's why the red, white, and blue must burn, baby, burn.
Thank you. want you to hear what I'm saying about this nation. Freedom supposed to be the format, but I step on your flag like it's a floor mat. Maim and mangle, the star spangled. I'm not trying to diss you. I use the flag like toilet tissue to wipe my black ass. What? You think that I'm a jackass? I see a flag and I attack fast with some fire. My desire to burn what Betty Ross sold up. The truth I show up about America, America, home of the brave, land of the free. Boom! This is the home of the slave. Now hold on, just a mother. Gave me freedom of speech in the First Amendment. So why trying to scold me when I toss you the flag? I'm only doing what you told me. You don't like it, so what? I'm not scared of you. Your flag, America too. See, I made up this new rule and I want y'all to learn it. Strike a match to the American flag and burn.